traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Kristen, of CIO of Sunrise Capital here. We spoke back in May, right when we kicked off this podcast, and you were pretty prescient at the time. You predicted a bit of a pullback. At the time, it was a time a little bit like now, though maybe not quite as bullish. Back in April and May, and there was indeed a pullback there in the early summer, but it didn't last long. If you recall, the rest of 2019 obviously was a very bullish year for the S&P and for basically all risk assets. But having you back on the show now, I'm curious where you see things. It would seem we're right for a pullback. I mean, this is looks like a making of a very crazy bull market, at least based on the last couple of days of and weeks of trading. So take it away. Where do you see things?
Okay, so let's set the backdrop. First things first, why are we here, right? Yeah. Why are we here? Why we're here is Fed policy. Everyone agrees with that, right? We have a very, very generous Fed policy. And so what appears to be happening is with rates at 1.5%, let's just call them that. I know it's a range of 1.5 to 1.75, whatever. You know, with Fed funds at 1.5%, what is happening is we are creating super inflation in risk assets. That's what I would call it, right? When you look at a stock like Apple going up 100% in a year, going up, you know, 50, 60% in 3 months, what you're doing is clearly creating some kind of super inflationary spike in risk assets as a result of low interest rates. The other thing we know that's happening, and I'll steal Fed Chair Powell's words here, is one of the collateral consequences or unintended consequences, apparently, of low rates has been a dampening of volatility, right? So these two things come together to create this environment where you see this incredible asymmetry in the market. And we've seen it basically since October 4th. Mm-hmm. Sort of since October 3, October 4, we've had now 65 straight trading days without a 1% pullback. There has been not one day where the market has pulled back 1% or more. Now, there are a handful of other times this has happened, and it always ends horribly. So it's easy for me to sit here on your podcast and say, listen, this is going to end horribly. I mean, that is going to happen. Can I tell you the day? Well, I'll prognosticate about that for you. So I'll go on the record and I'll tell you when I think it's going to happen. But what I'm going to tell you is it is going to happen because you can think of these things in physics terms, all right? There is potential energy and kinetic energy. And what do you know about potential energy? If you remember your physics, a big piece of calculating PE was, right, remember the distance from the ground, right? As X got larger, right, your PE got larger. And when it goes kinetic, it means business. So the reality is what I believe is happening here is, whereas last year we had kind of correction after correction. Yes, I predicted a lot of chop after May, and I was right. We had corrections, like a sort of 5% or an 11%, right? We kept having correction after correction as we were kind of stumbling to come out of that, break out of that zone. And the market was wringing its hands, I think rightfully so, about the trade conflict. We got some resolution to the trade conflict. Boom, out we go. And so what's happening now is you've removed, I think in the market's view, all of the systemic risk it can think of. You have this incredibly accommodative policy, and now we are building what I see as the dreaded asymmetric movement. I hate this movement. Understand something. It's really important for people to take this piece and wrap your head around it. Do you understand how many up days and down days there are on average if you go back through time immemorial in the equity markets? I'll save the punchline. The market goes up half the time and down half the time, 50-50. And do you know why that number is? Because if it wasn't 50-50, you would design a system that simply bought every single open, right? If it went up 52% of the time, it would be really easy. My job would be a piece of cake. You go out and raise a chunk of money, right? If you're a Citadel and you have a gazillion dollars, you just buy every open and sell every close. And you would guaranteed to make money over time because you own the blackjack table, right? If the odds of the blackjack table at, you know, in MGM Grand is 52%, the casino needs to just need to have you sit there. If you sit there, they're going to win. They just need people to sit there in a sufficient bank to handle the drawdowns when somebody wins big, right? And so the fact of the matter is the market goes up and down 50% of the time. Well, if you have days, we're going through stretches here where we have 14, 16, you know, straight up days. You have to understand that if you take a period of 65 trading days, and forget about the breadth of correction for a second, because the first statistic I talked about was breadth of correction. The second one is, I think, even more terrifying. There's only been a handful of down days out of every three trading weeks, week after week after week now. Well, statistically, we have to back end that. So it means we're going to go through one of these periods at some point where every day it's down. You know how fatiguing that gets, too. Remember back to the fourth quarter of 2018. Remember how that was every morning opening the thing and just seeing every market red, red, just painted red, and everyone was getting really tired of it. How long did it go on? 90 days, right? 3 months. And it felt never-ending. And so right now, we are a funny thing. Here we are, 90 days, sort of 3 months, pushing into the exact inverse, where it's every day. So rest assured, we're heading for a correction, and I would argue it's going to be terrifying when it comes, because now we have to undo a lot of this.
Okay, before we talk about the timing of it, and by the way, I'm going to take you up on your offer of providing the timing. Before we do that, let's talk about what could set this back, okay? Could it be something, I mean, we had the Iran thing, you know, which is pretty much already forgotten, right, 3 days afterwards. We had that. So there could potentially be, I mean, the Middle East is the Middle East. There could be some kind of a flare up there. There could be setbacks in this phase one thing with China, right? Or could there? What else is there that you think could potentially, as far as catalysts for the next selling?
Event? So here's the thing, and I don't want to be cute, but I'm going to say this anyway. It's anything that causes the investors to lose confidence in the market. Right. Now, that's an important statement because remember, a lot of December and November of 2018, we've tried to postscript that around the famous sort of October 3rd Fed meeting where they raised rates and then like he raised them one more time in December, I think, didn't he? Just to make a point. And it was like, this is on autopilot. Nonsense. What happened was that sell-off just fed on itself as pure fear. So the real answer to your question is pure fear comes into the market and there's lots of ways that can come in. So we'll come to the second piece of it. What's the likely catalyst? All right. First of all, I'll start by saying you never hear the bullet that kills you. Remember that. So whatever it is, we're probably not talking about it because if we were, you'd be ducking and you'd have your helmet on, right? So it's going to be something that catches us kind of off guard, I think. So the top candidates for me are all right. First of all, something really weird could come out of Iran. Like now that is on the table and that wasn't on anyone's radar. And we were kind of looking at it going, well, that's weird, right? I mean, that's interesting. That's the first time Iran has ever fired its ordnance on U.S. assets and owned it in history. Okay, every other time it was a proxy firing, it was laid off on like the Hezbollah or whomever, like some other militia. But this is the first time Iran said, yep, we fired the missiles on you, all right? To say that that's not a turning point is probably pretty naive. Now, how does it work its way through the markets? Well, there's lots of ways to think about that. First of all, imagine the morning you wake up. Let's just say that there's a re-escalation. Let's just say hypothetically there is. I'll take you through one scenario. Okay, there's a re-escalation. Let's say Iran fires off a cyber attack. All right, and it's effective. By the way, how would you feel if that cyber attack hit the New York Stock Exchange or hit the CME? Let's talk about that for a minute. What do you think would happen if all price transparency gridlocked up and went away in our markets for 10 minutes, let alone 10 hours? All right, that should give some people some pause because that's a zero market, right? That's like we wake up and you don't know what anything's worth. We're back to OTC. People are really right? All the liquidity locks up, all the price transparency. So that's, you know, that's like this sort of weird Armageddon scenario, but why is it so unimaginable? Cyber attack launched on the exchanges could be really effective, right, and terrifying. All right. So there's that piece. But let's just say there's a run-of-the-mill cyber attack on some big segment of business or something, and that causes a re-escalation. What do you think would happen if we began to fire on Tehran, military installations, and it comes out that there's a Russian attaché there advising, and some Russian guys get, you know, hurt in that, right? I mean, we know that Iran gets its weapons from Russia. We know that they have a close relationship. In other words, like, is it really so hard to imagine a way that this actually does start to suck really other important countries into this mess? Like, you don't want Russia squaring off against us across that border by any set of facts that play out. That is not a normal correction in the market, obviously, right? So again, it's another scenario. You can assign a probability of being very low. Like, Chris, that sounds far-fetched. Is it really so far-fetched? Do you not think an attaché didn't maybe move over there to advise them on maybe next steps and what to do? I don't know. I don't know the answer. Someone in our intelligence community does. So there's a real hotbed of risk around there. I don't know what it is, but it's there. Second thing, let's talk about this big deal in China, which is nothing. It's nothing. And I'll tell you my prediction there. I bet you he scraps any deal the day he's reelected. I will bet you by December 2020, we are in a full-blown, no ends, no holds barred trade war with China. You heard it here first. That's my big bet. I guarantee you. You know why? He's just a hawk on China. This is a guy that's still mad about the hostage crisis from 1980, 1984. I remember it as a little kid, right? He said, I'll blow up one of your 52 of your assets, one for each of the hostages you took in the CIA hostile Iran crisis. He's mad about these old things. I think they want to take down China. They see China as an economic threat. They don't want a better deal. They want to take them down and take them out as a leading economy, period. So I believe that this was just, hey, I can't have the stock market go down. I need it kind of roaring while I'm going to be reelected. But if he's reelected, you watch how fast that whole trade thing evaporates. And that's why nothing's happened. That agreement reduces the existing tariffs by 10%. That's it. That's it. We didn't put any new ones on. All the other ones are still sitting there. They've just been reduced effectively across the whole swath by 10%. So to me, you look at it, I say, so number two, and that's like a far way out. I'm not saying we're going to rally all the way to there. But another thing people ought to really think about is if the Democrats can't put up a reasonable candidate to beat him and he goes back in and wins, I think immediately thereafter, you better have your trade war helmet back on, because now he's not playing for another reelection. And I think then we find out how hawkish he really is on China. And I bet you, I personally bet it's going to be full-blown nonstop trade war, period, all for 2021. All right. But the real thing that probably causes like a correction between now and then, you know, like what I'm most scared about, I don't like that repo market move. I don't like that move, Nate. That is all wrong. And I'm telling you right now. So I was on a webcast panel yesterday, and we talked about it. It was mainly a private equity panel. All right. I was just there to give a kind of global macro overview. And one of the partners from Ares, which is a massive private equity firm, massive, was on that panel next to me. And he said, you know, one thing that we're seeing is, he said that it's getting harder to achieve the leverage in their private equity offerings, meaning they can't sell the debt piece. They can't sell the debt piece. So they're having to either put up more cash and decrease that cash to ratio, right? Cash to debt ratio. But either way, he kind of looked at me. He said, what do you make of that? That's what he asked me. And I said, that's really interesting, because that's not insight I would necessarily have. I mean, I'm not, you know, he's like, increasingly, we're seeing the investment banks get hung on these deals. They can't move the paper. And I said, you know what that is? Like, the trader in me says right away is, look, the bond bubble we're in, and no one would disagree we're in one. When it ends, who the heck knows, but whatever, we're in one. It's kind of like a rising tide lifts all boats, right? What we've seen is so much bond buying, such a rally in coupon, right? And everywhere across the board and junk and everything, that I guess what you're seeing is now these PE deals, the coupon is so high and the interest rate is just not attractive. You're starting to feel it there, right? So this is interesting to me, because it's the first time you're hearing about bond weakness. And I've long said that if the Fed, for whatever reason, loses control of the long end of the curve. So remember, it's just a watershed of debt instruments, right? Maybe it starts out in that private equity stuff, right? Rolls through to junk, rolls through to sovereign, you know, and by the way, equity is just debt in the end too, right? Has, you know, right, has voting rights, and it doesn't have bankruptcy rights, and it gets a dividend, but it's just debt. So then it rolls to equities. So still the most probable crack comes out of fixed income. And, you know, I mean, I Stan Druckenmiller just kind of gave his annual punt on things. And what did he say? He's short the 10-year and the 30-year. He's timidly long equities, but he's short bonds now. And that's really interesting to me, because that's an interesting bet. And there's zero chance the equity market stands up to a massive debt sell-off. Zero.
Yeah. Interesting. But okay. So do you think that this weakness in the bond markets, it sounds like there's a bit of a the demand, the buyers have are there's le- there's fewer buyers, it sounds like, right? And that would, that means less risk appetite. And that's, you know, that's how things start, right? I mean, once you start getting people who aren't interested in buying those pieces of paper, then, you know, to your point, it kind of trickles down the whole capital structure, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, then here's another piece. So one theory for a near term correction would be something sparking in the bond market. How imminent is it? Well, I say to you, the Fed had to jump in to quiet down the repo market. So I think it's maybe a little more imminent than people realize. Right. That's item one. Item two, Bernanke made the case last weekend for negative rates. Hmm. What if negative rates spike volatility? Stop and think about that for a minute. Right now, we know that low interest rates have dampened vol. We have a sense that as rates tried to renormalize, volatility appeared to come back to the market. Though it's interesting, I don't know that rates moving up just as high as they did were really the cause of the volatility. It could also have been trade conflict, right? Because those two things kind of happened, you know, concurrently. But let's just think about this for a minute. What if rates went negative and that caused a vol event? What would the Fed do? Re-raise? You think raising would then quiet the vol event? Right. Again, imagine a world where something happens where the fix reversing course is actually a problem. Wouldn't that be interesting? Rates go negative, the markets freak out, there's a crack, there's a vol spike, and now the Fed is left like, uh-oh, you know, we got to take rates back out of negative territory, but the move to tighten terrifies the market even more. Right? So you could see, you can imagine, again, that's just a loss of control scenario. Right? I mean, that's just another piece of this. But what I think causes the next correction, and I think it's going to be much scarier than folks realize, is going to be a volatility-led sell-off. Mm-hmm. And I think it happens in the first quarter. By March 31st, we're down 18-20%. And here's how this plays out. So if you look back to the last time we saw anything like this was January of 2017, right? That market was in the overbought condition that I described, no 1% down move, for 100 days, 100 trading days. That's a six-month period, okay, because it's only 20 trading days in a month, right, more or less. So, and that was the most it's ever been. There was another time that tied it, and it also had a horrible correction afterwards. The interesting thing with that correction, if you think about it, is what happened was, when the vol piece cracked, imagine you're a volatility market maker, and you'd say, based upon your model, which is looking at the expected standard deviation or expected range of the market's movement over the last 30 days or 20 trading days, you say, right now we're trading a 19 vol. And someone on your sales desk comes in and says, I need a price in a half a billion vol, and you offer 27, and they pay you. Well, you can't cover that in the vol market. So you turn around to your S&P dealer and you go, 10,000 yours. And then the next guy comes in and says, I need a price of 250 million volume. It's been paid at 27. You go, I'm offered at 33. And he takes you. And there's, again, nothing between. And so now you turn around and you go, another 20,000 yours in the S&P. Right? That is what happened. Mm-hmm. People don't understand that what happened was the S&P didn't sell off. Volatility exploded. Mm-hmm. And the only way to hedge infinite risk as vol was going up and up and up and up and up was to look over to the S&P and sell the S&P. That is the delta hedge against a pure vol buy. So if volatility comes undone again, it will drive in a disproportionate manner the equity markets lower, materially lower. So what did we see the other day? Guess what article just dropped literally within the last 24 hours? Bloomberg popped out an article where it did just this analysis, and it said that the short ratio in the biggest ETF on Earth, S&P ETF on Earth, is 1% to 99%.
Okay. So 99%, 1% of the borrow is short?
That's right. 1%. Right. The last time it got there, guess when the last time it got there was?
1999.
No, oh. 2017, okay. End of 2017, right into 2018, right into the vol. It was January of 2018, the last time we saw that level. Hmm. So here we are again in this really unhedged, overbought market. So I always say, history doesn't repeat itself, but it tends to rhyme. Mm-hmm. Here we are again. The market wildly unprotected. The market incredibly overbought. I mean, and what's interesting to me is I think a lot of folks aren't paying attention to, like, Tesla. Why do you think Tesla went up as much as it went up? Do you think it went up because people buying it or because they're covering shorts? Does that look like a move to you that was like people fear of missing out, or does that look like a margin call to you? To me, it looks like a margin call, okay? That was somebody covered massive shorts in there, right? They just got instructed, take these off, pay any price. Tesla was going up $27 a day, Nate. That's a 5% move a day.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, you know, that's a short squeeze. That's a short covering. But like that type of that type of panicked buying comes in near-term highs. So every statistic I'm looking at is telling me, so now the only question is, does it happen in February? Does it happen in February? And here's the funny thing. So somebody just yesterday, CNBC put an article out, somebody just yesterday placed this $4 million, that's an unlevered $4 million. So levered, it's a huge bet. That by February 29th, I think there's 29 days this year, right? It's a leap year, I think.
It is.
Right. So by Feb 29th, he has a bet on that we touch 25 vol. Somebody big just put it on. And it's interesting. So I think that that's a little too cute. And the reason why I think that is because we had the last volatility blow up in February. So it probably won't happen in February. I know that's not a very scientific reason, but things tend not to do the exact same thing. But it might come before January's end, or certainly by the end of March. You know, like if everyone's like saying, well, we probably won't blow up until February, then no one's looking for the truck right now as they're crossing the road. We get into February, I think there's a high probability we do more of the same through February. And then I think March, it's just, because also by then we'll be overbought by that 100 days again. We'll now tie the highest two times without that 1% correction. So if we can push through Jan and into Feb, we're going to be touching that 100 level. You'll have the totally unhedged market, and every statistic will be telling you you're going to have a spike. And so then you say to yourself, okay, so that's just a correction. Except I believe, for the reasons we discussed in our last podcast, that correction will not look like people anticipate it will look like. Because what happens is volatility adjusts far faster than people understand now, because computers adjust volatility, because computers control the liquidity stack. So the liquidity degrades, we talked about this, right? Volatility explodes, and then you have this outsized correction. Mm-hmm. And you have all kinds of people that have just been sucked in at these incredible highs.
Mm. Okay, let's play this out though a little bit. Like how, I mean, look, the economy is still in decent shape, right? And ultimately, all these dips, there's gonna be a selling event, but every single selling event in the last 10 years has resulted in, except for the fourth quarter of 2018, maybe, 2018, has been pretty, you know, there's been a rebound, right? Do you think there's anything to sustain selling? I mean, the Fed could still lower rates. They could do further liquidity injections, right? The Trump could come out with some bullish talk about tax cuts or who knows what, right? So there seems to be like a lot of willingness, especially by the government, to see this rally through. So once there is this selling event, I guess the question to you is, how significant is it going to be, and will it go on for more than just a couple of days?
Right. So absent some accompanying meaningful economic woe, in other words, like some sector blowing up or some kind of liquidity crisis that's weird and unanticipated, even in the face of obviously all this generous liquidity, absent some facts to sustain a selling story, absolutely you would fade it, right? For all the reasons you just said, right? You have very accommodative policy, right? You have, you know, you have a central bank, coordinated central banks that kind of want to see this thing through. You know, here's an interesting concept for you. So I guess this past weekend at the Brook Institute, I think it's the Brook Institute, if I'm not butchering that.
Brooking.
You know, you had Draghi and Yellen on the stage, right? And one of the two, might have been Draghi, you know, broke out the term the Japanification of an economy. Okay.
Yeah.
That was a really interesting concept when you think about it, particularly coming out of a central banker who never would have uttered that word while he was in, you know, the head of the ECB. Now, all of a sudden, Are we getting a little bit of like that? That was an interesting snapshot into some of the things these guys were talking about inside the ECB. Japanification. They were worried that sustained quantitative easing in Europe would cause a massive period of stagflation, right? And basically just flatline their economy. Like we were talking again on that private equity panel, they talked, one of the issues they raised, they said, what sectors or geographies do you see as opportunity? And the Ares GP said, well, we still like the US. And I said, of course you do. Because why would you like Europe if it's being Japanified? Like, does anybody charging into Japan, have you ever heard anyone on a private equity panel go, we love Japan, we're gonna run in there for our next policy, right? There's no growth over there. There hasn't been forever because they did, like we have an example of this. And what I wonder is, if all of a sudden Europe gets tagged with a Japan moniker, like you have to stay out of it, it's garbage, it's not gonna grow, they're finished, they overdid it, they pushed it, then everyone's gonna pivot and look to the US and go, wait a minute, did they cross that imagined meridian? Are we through it? Wouldn't that cause an interesting conversation? Because if all of a sudden everybody's like, wait a second, super low rates, this is real. Now, you know, Germany's gonna sit in a malaise for the next 30 years and there's real outflows. You have to ask yourself, again, like I said, do we start to sort of materialize another narrative? Look, here's the deal. You know, and I said this yesterday, I say it again. We're gonna have another recession. You understand that. At some point we're not gonna never have another recession again. It doesn't need to be the mother of all recessions, like 08. It can be something more mild, but they are healthy, they are cyclical, they should occur. And I sincerely hope the Fed allows one to happen because I think it will be better for, you know, kind of resetting, flushing out, and letting us go into that next phase of a bull market. I don't think we need to sit back and be terrified every time a little volatility creeps into the market. You know, that's probably not a great policy. And, you know, Stan Druckenmiller's position was, it may not happen in his lifetime, but it will come back at some point and cause something horrendous. Mm-hmm. You know, if this is the policy they truly adapt. Mm-hmm. You know, the other issue that keeps coming up is there's no inflation. So, and the way it's usually explained is through Amazon, at least in part, right? That like Amazon's made everything cheaper and so, right? Well, did anybody step back and think that maybe it's just because the cost of capital has gone to like nothing?
Yeah.
Isn't that the most important input to everyone's business, your cost of capital? I mean, if you have good revenues, you use your own capital to reinvest in, but like otherwise, if you're borrowing capital or accessing it, if your cost of capital goes to like nothing, then it's pretty hard to imagine inflation. Like that is the most important input component, isn't it? I mean, somebody who's got a PhD in economics, correct me, swoop in and say, you're wrong, Chris, for these 10 reasons. But like one thing we've seen is that the last bond bear market was in the late 70s, correct?
I think so, yeah.
Right? And since then, the bond market's been in a bull market since. So like certainly since like 77, I mean, whatever the heck it is, like let's call it 1980, it's just been straight up in bonds. And so interest rates have been, you know, with their hiccups, gone basically straight down. And what have we seen? Inflation goes straight down. They line up together rather nicely. So like maybe you ought to like increase the cost of capital and see if that in some way brings in some inflation. If that's, I don't know. I'm not the guy that has the PhD in economics, like, and I'm not on the Fed board. But to me, it seems like a reasonable and certainly a plausible explanation for why we're seeing no meaningful inflation other than in risk assets, which has been hyper. Inflation.
And maybe that's where it is, right? I mean, because, you know, any economics textbook will tell you that if you lower interest rates long enough, and keep them low long enough, that will result in higher prices, right? That will result in inflation. And there's many examples in history. And you know, these last 10 years are kind of like an anomaly for whatever reason. You know, maybe part of it is that, you know, the US dollar being the reserve currency and the fact that the U.S. can just do this and everyone will buy our treasuries no matter what. And that'll shore up the currency and the fact that it's all flowed into these assets, right? But as far as the real economy is concerned, the price of goods and services, I mean, you know, it's not, it has increased somewhat, but it's not anything that would appear to be inflationary, right?
So the interesting thing is, like, I liked listening to Stan on this point. You know, he said inflation is really hard to predict. Yeah. You know, we don't do a good job. So it's, you know, like when you think about the number being at 1.9, he's like, well, that could really be 2.6 pretty easily. or 1.6 because we're really not very good at it. It's not like one of these numbers you should take at the face value. Mm-hmm. And so there is inflation. Mm-hmm. It is there, you know, I mean, it is there. And so we have achieved it to some extent. And we don't really know how much it's dampened by the Amazon effect, things like it, you know, and, you know, and also, as I said, the cost of capital, that input coming down materially. So we just don't know. I mean, the fact of the matter is we just don't know. We do know that we formed monopolies. We have, like, in the form of, like, things like Google and Facebook and Amazon. They have basically monopolies, more or less. I mean, there's one competitor with Amazon. It's, you know, Walmart. But, you know, and those guys are still competing with one another and haven't raised prices yet. But when you give people those monopoly power, typically they eventually do begin to ratchet up the price on people, like we saw Netflix do, right? They kind of had monopoly power on streaming, and now, like, Disney's
that's
in the
gone.
Game.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right, that's gone. And so now it's a little harder for them to, you know, obviously with good content, they've tried to do it. But so the really interesting thing is, I think, you know, inflation, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that we measure it that well. So I don't, it's hard for me to say where it really is. But what I am really good at is looking at the market's price movement. That we are really good at over here, and understanding the mechanics of why and how markets move, and understanding that this market is way overbought. Like, it's that simple for people's money, for their purpose. Like, you need to understand that you are in, you know, when you look at any chart that starts to have this like J formation and just hook up like this, it history has not been kind to it. We are not in a new dawn. Like, rates have been lower where they are here, and there have been less, you know, global, you know, macro issues, and we've had wild corrections. So it's coming. You know, the actual headline that scares the living daylights out of everybody and gets everyone to start selling, I don't know that there needs to be one. Mm-hmm. It could be as simple as a risk parity model on a really big portfolio firing to lighten equities because now equities have become, you know, too overbought or something, you know, by their own metric, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, there might be a vol floor where they go, we don't like this anymore. We, you know, sort of target this volatility. And if vol's sitting around 14, we're kind of comfortable actually being long equity, but they get that when it moves too many standard deviations one way or the other. I can come up with a lot of scenarios where you trigger some real selling, real rebalancing, or maybe debt bleeds off and people are like, oh, that's a good deal. Like, we're going to go over and lighten some equities. We've accumulated, you know, like, because the market's moved up 9% in 6 minutes, we need to, like, now shave off some of that gain and roll it over here, you know? So if some big portfolios start rebalancing out and rolling off some of the gain to, like, because now they're all of a sudden 70, they're overweight equities. I mean, that's the other way you get overweight, Nate. You just go up too much.
Yeah.
So at some point, you might just hit a natural trigger point where pensions flip the other way and start selling. And that's your trigger. And by the way, can I say, aren't those the scariest corrections? The ones where no one knows why it started?
Yeah, like 87, right? Yeah.
2015. We don't have to look that far. Remember, like, that weird August afternoon where, you know, Bridgewater fired that massive order and dropped the market 1,100 points, right? I mean, it's just, you know, I think it was in October, actually, of 2015. Mm-hmm. But in any event, and it caused a hailstorm for the next 3 months. And it was like, it just took somebody big to fire an off-size order, right? Because that's the thing people forget, right? There's 95% of the assets are in 5% of the hands.
Mm-hmm.
95% of the total assets invested, 5% of the people control.
Wow.
So that means one
who,
only.
Who are those five? Do you know, incidentally? What, CalPERS? What?
It's CalPERS, CalSTRS, Texas Teachers. It's 5%, right? Like, it's Bridgewater. It's, you know, you can go out there. Just look at the top asset managers, right? That's easily searchable. And what you'll see is, you know, by every statistic, Bloomberg did a great study on this. It's not that old. It's maybe a year or two old. It was really cool. They did it with Venn diagrams. So it really made it, you know, like, it drove it home when you saw, like, the sun and then these tiny moons, like, you know, the size of the Earth compared to the sun, you know, were like literally this little tiny dot. And it really showed, like, how massive the handful of, like, you know, top asset managers are. And so these folks are out there and they make the decisions. If they decide to turn the ship, they turn the ship, and when the rest of us are just the boats in the ocean, when the tidal wave comes through and we have no idea it's coming, there's no headline to warn you. So I know we always think of the prototypical correction coming from, you know, Iran fires missiles on the U.S. It doesn't need to do that. You know, it can be, gee whiz, why the heck is the Dow set to open down 700? What's that about? You know, I also wonder, I don't know. I mean, it was interesting how Brexit went from being this really horrible thing to viewed as this positive thing. We'll see if that comes back. I am like lightly curious. I know no one thinks about it. No one really cares about it too much, but it is like almost as a sport. I sit back there and I think like, hey, you know, does that do something? Look, the single biggest risk to the market is that it's wildly underhedged. Mm-hmm. When the put-to-call ratio drops out to where it is right now, it's pretty simple. People are doing the following calculus. They're saying, why pay for the insurance?
Yeah.
And that risk is on. Your single biggest. Yeah, it's risk on huge, but, you know, when the last guy buys the last share, whoever that is, wherever he is, you know, and a cool wind blows through the market and it's like, well, all right, we're all on board now. We're all strapped in. We're all ready to go. And if we pushed the way we pushed it, I think we need to go. I mean, we just tore through 3,000 to 3,300.
Yeah.
This last 10% has been just, we haven't explored any of these levels. We haven't, you know, had any meaningful examination. I did think it was interesting that the other night, the algos were able to push the market all the way down to 3181. Overnight. 3181. A lot of people don't understand that. The S&P, so the Dow moved, what it moved, 400 and something points down and 700 points up to close. So it moved 1,100 points in that 24-hour span. So from the close at 1 o'clock to the close the next day, it moved 1,100 points. The S&P went down to 81. I think it went out around 35. So that's 35, 25. So it went down, what, 55 handles, and it closed up. It retraced those 55 handles plus maybe another 15 or 20. So it moved 130, 140 handles. You think that's a 12 vol, Nate?
Yeah.
That sound like a 12 vol to you?
Well, what is it in percentage terms, though? Like, that's it's less than it was. Like,
well, no, but that's a 4% move. What okay, is that yeah, in vol terms? What yeah. is it in vol terms? It's a 26.
Yeah.
It's a 26. The futures vol right now is 26. The actual vol is trading at 12. So that means that like exactly 36 hours ago or whatever, like 48 hours, 2 days ago, right? 2 days ago, we printed a 26 vol. Actually, 40 full handles would be like a 36 vol. But I mean, like we basically traded at like a 27, 28 vol for that 28 4-hour period. But the VIX is trading at 12 right now. That's what I tried to explain to you. If the structure can adjust that much, if we can create that kind of movement in the market, that figure is a lie. that is a lie. It is not. I understand you can transact at that number, and people believe that is where vol will buy and sell, and that is fine. I am here to tell you that the vol of this market is materially higher like that.
Cool. All right, Chris Stan, I want to take a short break. I want to come back and ask you some stuff and specifically also get into this, what investors should do in the short term. But let's take a short break first.
Sure.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else you find podcasts. Search for Contrarian Investor and Supply an honest rating. We want to hear from our listeners. Probably the most efficient way to submit feedback is through the Breaker app, available on the Apple App Store. If you prefer, you can email contrarianpod@gmail.com. You can follow us on social media as well, on Twitter @podcontrarian and on Instagram @contrarianpod. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program.
So one thing I like to do after when we return from the break usually is ask the guest about there. And this is something that I failed to do when I talked to you the first time when we met out in San Diego, where you're based, back in May. But it's to get into the background a little bit of the investor and just talk about like what I call their origin story and how they came about to investing. So maybe you can just talk us through that a little bit, your background and how you came about and how you started things out there in San Diego.
All right. So the firm is celebrating its 40th anniversary.
Oh, yeah, you can see the little numbers back there.
Yeah, it's 40 years in business. So Sunrise Capital Partners really was one of the very first quantitative hedge funds that ever existed. We pioneered the space. The only firm as old as us would be Campbell. Campbell and Sunrise, mm-hmm. first two quant hedge funds ever. And things were much more collegial back then. The founders of Sunrise Capital, which were three guys, Rick Slaughter, Jack Forrest, and Gary Davis, Gary and Jack were academic radiologists. They were MDs. They were doing studies on cancer cell migration and things like that. And they took those models and they deployed them on markets and found that the way that those algorithms tracked momentum, in essence, or migration and growth, worked really well for predicting when trends would begin and, you know, when trends were beginning and were likely to continue. Okay. And so Bourne was the quantitative, you know, industry, because what they did that nobody else did was create a strategy that relied on computers to crunch data input and generate trade ideas, right? And then to follow those trade ideas religiously, you know, as James Simon said in an interview I heard once, you know, he said, you have to be a slave to the machine. Mm. You have to slavishly follow the machine. Take the trades when they don't make sense to you. Take the trades when you don't, you know, understand logically why it would work. Because they're just chasing a statistical outcome, right? And if statistically they're correct, they'll win. And so the firm enjoyed a great deal of success for years and years and years, and they built one of the first hedge funds, and we're really on ground zero for the big hedge fund boom. And so the firm enjoyed a great deal of success. And over the years, our business has gone through lots of changes, you know, with that success and with the way the market's changed and this gravitation for all the assets to just a few managers. I imagine there was a time when our firm may have been positioned to really be in that arms race, you know, but I don't think the original founders had that ambition. They didn't want to manage every dollar on the table. We could prognosticate about, you know, whether that was a good idea or not, but I think they were experiencing a measurable success, and their, you know, view was to keep their arms around it at that size or smaller. In any event, over time, we found that what was happening was two things, that the markets themselves were changing. So there were two things that began to challenge hedge fund returns. This is a narrative people know really well. It all started, people believe, post 08. And post 08 played a big role in it, because post 08, we implemented quantitative easing and low rates. And as we touched on earlier, that caused volatility to dampen. And as you dampen volatility, you removed a lot of the hedge fund alpha driver. Because what we all find out in the end is that hedge funds were all basically synthetically long vol traders somehow. However it manifested itself, they were able to capitalize on the short side for long periods of short side and spikes and all kinds of good, you know, volatility. When you took that out and created the more linear return of the equity markets, that grinding, and as those indexes tracked higher, you removed a lot of the lifeblood. The other thing that people talk less about, and something we talked about a little bit before, is that the markets went electronic. And in 2003, when markets went electronic and we handed over the market-making architecture to algorithms, we changed the composition and the way that markets move. And that evolved, right? Remember the rule that, like, your technology was obsolete in 18 months?
Yeah. More so.
That euphemism? Well, imagine then what was happening in the financial markets. Mm-hmm. As we were transitioning global liquid markets over to algos and higher frequency market makers, and handing over that architecture to a set of computers to provide the baseline liquidity, right? Gone were the market makers in liquid products, and replaced were the algos that would sit in there and contractually make markets all day, all night for the big exchanges. And that fundamentally changed the way markets move, how fast they move, volatility, a lot of what we just talked about a few minutes ago, how far things can move and all that good stuff. So our firm recognized that along the way, and we began to adapt our trading for that reality. Once we understood, and it took us a while to figure out the importance of those structural changes, and then it took us some time to understand and figure out ways to monetize the new inefficiencies that they presented, which were very, very different. And required an awful lot of more, guess what, computing power and computing expertise, because now you really had to play in a cyber game at cyber speeds, and you were kind of out of this human game. Humans don't move the market anymore. It's not people picking the phone and going, sell, buy. It's not how it works anymore, my friend. It is being moved at tenths of a second, hundredths of a second, ten thousandths of a second by machines. right? And that's how you have the Flash Boys and all this like scandal with people jumping orders and gaming the stack and all stuff. There's real money to be made there, and that's why those folks are doing that. And so there's everything from that to right on out to how do you understand momentum and what drives markets today? And that's what we've spent a lot of time studying over the last few years. And we think we have our arms around it finally. And it took a long time to get here. And we think we have solutions for the way things move today. And when I say solutions, you know, you can make the index had a wonderful year last year. You know, you can put your money in the index. And I would say investors should have a sizable chunk of their money in the indexes. Why not? They're free. The Fed's behind you trying to push them that way. There's a policy of making them go higher, right? Certainly under this presidency. Mm-hmm. But you may want to also find out how to add an alpha component, at least for sophisticated investors. How do I add something that returns differently? Maybe it beats the S&P, maybe it doesn't, maybe. But if it finds a way to make its money a different way, that's what we're interested in. Mm-hmm. We're still interested. We can get the index now. That's easy. Just put some money in the index, buy the SPY and leave it alone. What do you do with the other 40% of your money? Because certainly holding bonds and hoping for enough appreciation to turn the index negative is not attractive. Holding gold, in our opinion, is awful too, right? I mean, like, I get it. It's up at 1600 again and whatever. But gold was just down at 1150 not that long ago. So, I mean, gold can just turn around on you. It's like, you know, it's like Warren Buffett said, if you were an alien and you came down from space, you wouldn't understand why anybody owned it. You pay to buy it. You pay to store it. You pick it up and move it from here and put it in the dirt. You take it out of the dirt here and you put it in a safe here, and it's supposed to be an investment. You can't do anything with it. Anyway, you get the idea. So for us, our ethos is how do we find a ways to generate non-index return? And if that is non-correlated to the market, then we believe it has utility to investors to help do something else in their book when and if finally Fed policy changes or something presents itself to the market that no one sees coming. Do you really want to be caught with no solution?
Mm. How do you go about doing that? Like, what's your strategy of producing this?
So today we have two what you would consider to be hedge fund quality strategies, right? So what I mean by that sentence is simply we have two strategies that are attempting to deliver return in a way that is not index investing or simply just following, riding the bull move up in the indexes, at, you know, the U.S. equity markets. One is a long short volatility strategy. We have developed a method of buying and selling volatility futures, and it looks awfully promising. In its first 13 months were outstanding since we launched it. It's the research that underlies it is outstanding, and we believe it is a really nice way to make, you know, to make money in your portfolio. That's how we see it. We say, look, you, like I said, the money's going to be there in the index, but we love this because this thing performs really well when volatility gets upset. It does okay when volatility does nothing. That's okay. We found a way to pull some money out of that as well. But when volatility, you know, it gets upset, this thing is there. So you can think of it as, even though we are intraday trading, you know, long and short vol, we've found a way, we believe, to synthetically buy puts, right?
Okay.
To synthetically acquire volatility and asymmetric bets on the market, okay? That is one of our two strategies. The other strategy is a long short equity strategy. And it is an intraday, trades just equity futures, it trades the S&P, you know, the NASDAQ and the Dow, and it trades those futures long short, day in, day out. And now, how is that different than indexing? Well, I'll tell you how it's different. Since it steps in and out of its risk constantly, even if it's taking advantage of up move, it has no systemic exposure overnight. So you're not holding it for the headline, you know? It trades the most liquid markets and trades them very, very quickly. So it's in and out. So it gives you, you know, some headline protection. Oh, and by the way, it gets short a lot. So, you know, it is very robust in periods of time. We believe it will be very robust in periods of time like the fourth quarter of December. So we believe we will be able to monetize those periods by trading from the short side. Oh, and by the way, also buying some of those V bottoms as things snap off and dynamically trading the volatility another way, right? By long short futures. And so those are the two pieces of IP. That's where our firm is today. Those two pieces of IP are the methodologies we believe are compelling to add, you know, I guess, you know, and the term is, I know, like one that people don't like anymore, but to add alpha to a portfolio, to add a different way to make some money in a market that's presenting what seems to be a very easy way to make money right now.
Mm-hmm. And has this held up well over the last year where things have gone pretty much straight up? Has, you know, because you end up sacrificing a little bit of the upside if you have, if you're hedged that much, right?
So, you know, without getting ourselves in trouble with saying anything about performance and all that good stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm just generally.
No, I understand. All I'm going to say to you is that the long short volatility strategy, we believe by our subjective measurement, has performed extremely well over the first 13 months of its live trading.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely well. So we were very pleased with it. And I would say all day long, it's a compelling strategy for sophisticated people. Well, I mean really sophisticated stuff, you know, sophisticated money to have in their portfolio. My sales pitch is just that would be, hey, you know, you're going to get some good index money so long as the Fed is accommodative. That's going to be there. Is this blended in with that at some ratio? I don't know what the right ratio is. That's for everybody to decide. That's their call. You know, I think you can make a good faith argument. This would be a really nice compliment to your portfolio because, hey, you know, at least to the extent that past performance gives you any comfort about how it may or may not perform in the future. And we know it's not indicative of future performance because the future is always different. But, you know, it gives us confidence anyway, deploying it, that we think that it's we hope that those inefficiencies that we've identified will continue. The other thing we've seen, at least in the study of it, because, you know, whenever you invent something that's quantitatively driven, you know, you create a back test, another horrible word. No one likes them, right? Never seen a bad back test, right? But you create a study and you try and give yourself confidence that study is not curfed, and then you let it go in real life, and you hope that it performs exactly the way the simulated process runs. You run them in parallel and you get that part down. You go, okay, so now we know what the simulation, if we would have invented it today and tested it back, we'd have gotten this number, and we really got that number. So that's good. And the other thing we look for is it becoming more robust? Because remember, our thesis statement here is that we believe fundamentally the market has structurally changed. And when we unleashed computers into our market, we unleashed the rate of adaptation that computers bring to everything that they go to, whether it's e-commerce, whether it's transportation in the form of Uber and Lyft, whatever it is, when you put technology in there, you're guaranteed to if you're successful in disruption, to rapidly continue to evolve and disrupt, right? Just keep evolving. That's what computers do. They look at the back and they keep it. And what we're finding is that the AI that we've developed that looks at the AI that we know the market-making algorithms are using is we believe that our data shows that we're tracking them pretty well. So, you know, we're kind of hitching our horse to that wagon. And so long as they continue to run the show, I mean, do you really think tomorrow or any day, maybe there comes a day that we're going to stop using computers, restructure the entire liquidity of the equity markets, and go back to 5,000 people screaming at each other in a pit?
I rather doubt it.
It could happen through a massive cyber attack or something. Yeah. Maybe they try and come up with a backup plan. I don't know. We can imagine a scenario. But sort of. And by the way, if that happens, well, we have programs that worked, we believe, objectively incredibly well for 37 years, right? In that environment. So I think we have the stuff to pull off the shelf there to solve that problem if that's where we're going. And in the meantime, if what we're going to stay in is a computer-driven, computer-structured liquidity world, we think we have the product to do that.
Very cool. What's your background? You're not from San Diego, are you? Are you from out east?
I'm not. Yeah. And certainly with the 40 behind me, and I'm a spring chicken over here now. So my background is, you know, I studied engineering and applied math at Lehigh University.
Mm-hmm.
When I came out of undergrad, I felt like I hadn't studied all of math, but I was pretty close to it, right? I mean, if you're an engineer and applied science guy, you're going to get right to Green's theorem and the divergence theorem. You may not be doing Fields Medal work, but, you know, you're a couple more classes and you could probably have your math major as well. So I like to think of myself at least as maybe a quasi-math major. And when I came out, I thought to myself that the best opportunity set, I graduated school in 1993. It was a recession, by the way, right? Persian, right, the Persian War, Gulf War, and all that good stuff. But it's 1993. I think Clinton came in 94. So we were at the end.
Jan 93. He was elected in 92. Yeah.
Yeah, 92. Right. So he came in 93. So we had Clinton coming in, right? He came. And so I went to Wall Street and, you know, I pitched myself as I said, hey, you know, look, options at the end of the day, right? Whether they're on equities or currencies or otherwise, or just, that's just linear algebra, right? First derivative, second derivative, third derivative. I can make sense of this stuff. I can add value. They bit and off I went. I started at Swiss Bank Corp, which would later be bought by UBS, of course. But Swiss Bank Corp's an important place because they had merged with a group called O'Connor. And Swiss Bank O'Connor was incredible. They were the options gods. So it was a heck of a desk to be a part of, believe me. I mean, we were the preeminent option shop. I would then move over to JP Morgan right around 1994, and I would spend the next better part of a decade at JP Morgan, trading in the currency group in both New York and London, and then the commodity derivatives group towards the end of my tenure. From there, I went, and there I really learned the markets, right? Like I was a market maker and in very major market making seats, and I learned how markets worked, right? Like really, you know, I was the dollar Swiss trader in New York. I was the sterling trader at JP Morgan London, one of the biggest flow seats in the world, you know, and you learn to quote big business, two-way, unknown which way the interest was, to how to manage that risk, how markets were fluid in real time, what types of V-bottoms and patterns and things. I mean, we lived in like the golden age of global macro, right? Mm. I really did. I mean, that was when Soros had his amazing run. from there, I went to work. I thought I'd earned enough chops trading enough across enough products to get to move over to a discretionary global macro fund. I worked for one called Deerhurst. That was a gentleman, Andy Krieger. Andy Krieger was George Soros' chief currency strategist. Mm-hmm. Andy was a big deal. Andy helped break the pound. Okay. Mm-hmm. Andy was a big deal. Solomon Brothers options trader, brilliant options trader. One of the only people I've ever seen in my life. He's in Market Wizards. Like you can read about him. He's mm-hmm. one of the only people you ever saw in your life that could price an option. Like he could hear the price of an option and know it was wrong. Like the second he said, he's like, oh, take that one. That's wrong. You know, like he just, it was incredible. Really bright guy, really good trader. So I stayed there for a bit. And then right around 2002, I decided that I wanted to pivot towards private equity. That was my decision. That was my thinking. I thought the industry was set to explode. I was right. People were talking about hedge funds. They weren't talking about private equity firms yet. There was a little firm called BlackRock climbing up the street from where I was living, and I saw that, and I said, man, these guys are positioned to do some really interesting things. But I had never done any deal work. I was a little burned out from sitting in a trading seat. I was an all-discretionary trader, and at that point, a discretionary PM. I wanted to do something different. And so I went to law school and business school as an initial matter. I went to Northwestern Law and Kellogg Business School. Northwestern was certainly a top 10 law school. It was really surrounded by some incredibly smart people. I did not finish my MBA, but I started it. I was a little later in life, as you can imagine. I was sort of pushing my very early 30s at that point. I did, you know, I had a great experience at law school, and I came out, and then I joined Cravath, Swaine & Moore. Mm. Which is, you know, a very well-regarded, you know, law firm. And I practiced there for about 5 years in both as a hybrid, you know, as an initial matter in the corporate group, really in the securities practice, right? So I was right in the LBO, ground zero, 2006, 2007, right into the 2008 blow up, right there. I was on a lot of those deals that went out at 14 times leverage, 15 times through the basket, right? Like big deals that went out. Sort of, you know, big stuff, big sponsors, right? All the big names you think of, you know, coming out of a firm like that. And I got my deal chops. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, I worked the kind of 100-hour weeks, and I did the whole, you know, thing where I, you know, I really earned those deal chops. I then moved over for a period of time to a really high-octane litigation firm, Quinn Emanuel. John Quinn is a brilliant guy, and he had a cadre of corporate experienced guys in there because he was handling a lot of the litigation, representing, you know, suing the banks, you know, as plaintiff's counsel. And they were real good. They were really good at what they did, and it was a neat part. You know, really smart people. And then this opportunity came along. Mm. You know, right around 2011, there was an opportunity to join Sunrise Capital. And they were a big client of mine when I was at JP Morgan. I mean, back then, the firm was in the neighborhood of, you know, it was, you know, I won't throw a number on it, but it was in the billions, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it had a big B behind it at a time when people didn't manage $1 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were really big at a really good time, and in the late 90s and early 2000s. So I certainly knew who they were, and the opportunity, we started the conversation, and I had an opportunity to come out here and try and be an owner in something and really build a business. And that appealed to the private equity side of me. The trading piece, I loved that it was quantitative. I thought that was so interesting. I was like, wow, I'll get to dust off my engineering degree. As you know, as ridiculous as that may sound to you, you know, I was a very mathematical and practice-driven, theory-driven, pattern-driven manager for the first 12 years of my career. So it was a beautiful dovetail. I got to come in, work with some really smart people, some really good people too. This was a really good group of people that loved this company, built this company from the ground up and cared a lot about it, and being really good to its investors and fair with them. I liked everything about them. Hmm. So I've been here for 8 years, in my ninth year now. And it's been a lot of fun. And so I had a hand in the design, a really heavy hand in the design of our new volatility. It was a really nice marriage because as I spent the last 6 years re-spinning up and being immersed in every single tick of all the price movements around our existing IP as a PM, I had ideas about what we were seeing. And Rick, one of the three founding partners who's still a partner today at this firm and invented some of that first AI, he had some really interesting ideas about what he was seeing in price structure. And the two things came together and we went into the laboratory and it took a good two and a half years to get these things ready. You know, and so when we launched, so we got, you know, we got the volatility. So that this concept of understanding that fact that price structure has changed gave rise to both systems. They have independent IP, but theoretically the idea is, hey, people think things are more stable than they are. They're not that stable. And we think if we understand that liquidity structure, we can see when that liquidity structure is degrading or reconstituting, maybe forming that kind of V-bottom. And maybe we can develop systems that look for certain patterns and track that sort of degradation and sort of reconstitution of the liquidity structure around that. And so we developed a method, because obviously that is volatility. That is volatility, right? Because that defines range, and volatility is just what? A predictor of range. That's all it is. And so once you understand that, you can say to yourself, well, heck, if we can get good at understanding liquidity structure, we can get good at trading the volatility that derives its price from that. And if we can get good at understanding liquidity structure, we can probably develop some systems that will be good at trading the very products that are that. So think about it in linear math. One is the first derivative, and the second is the second derivative. The first derivative is you follow liquidity to track the movement of the S&P, that's derivative one, and then the derivative on that derivative, the second derivative, is the volatility. And so, cool. So we released, you know, like I said, we went live with the Vol strategy last December of 2018, and for the whole year of 2019, and we've been really pleased with the outcome. Cool. And so now the job is for us to rebuild, you know, the assets, you know, go out and convince people and regrow our asset base and tell them we've been here for 40 years. We've been really good at what we've done since then. We were around when these other big guys were small. We were big and they lapped us. They made better business decisions or different business decisions, not better, not worse, whatever they did, what they wanted to do. We did a different thing. And now we're here to say Alpha's not dead. That would be our message. It's not dead. Like yes. That. We're not going to tell you don't index invest. No one would say that with a straight face. I'm just saying maybe add something else to your book. So that's it. So that's who
Very
we are.
Cool. Very cool. All right. So let's talk about practically what, you know, obviously you guys have this whole system of algorithms and stuff, but what would you do as a retail investor here? If you had your choice, like what types of hedges do you think might be cheap? And are there any assets that are undervalued at this point?
So first of all, if I were a retail investor, the first thing I would say is to retailers, block out noise. Mm-hmm. It's important to block out noise. Let's block out noise because that creates chop. And as a retail investor, since you're not actively trading, please don't, you know, get caught in the chop. The second thing I would say is as an investment process, which is a really simple one to apply, why don't you make a list of companies that you really like, that you believe in, that are really strong, that you agree with their ethos, you like with their businesses, and you would love to own them. Okay, so let's just say that list is, you know, maybe has Apple on it or this one and that one. As you look at that list, I would encourage people to cull out the haymakers, right? Don't throw any haymakers. I just think that's leave that to professionals to get in. Wait till they emerge. It's okay. You don't need to get it on the ground. I know everyone wants to tell that story. It's okay. If you bought Apple at 150, you've obviously done just fine up here at 300, right? So like, just wait till it develops. Be patient. It was okay to buy Amazon at 700, wasn't it? Just fine. You could have bought Google at 500, right? It was like, let it, you didn't need to get it at $90. That's my point. Like, or, you know, at the IPO. So like, be patient, let the story form your wish list. Now, the next thing I would do is I would index some money, because being a stock picker is dangerous. And so if you have like this chunk of money you want to invest, why don't you take the first chunk of it and put like 80% of it into an index, okay? The last 20%, now use that for your dream list of stocks and see how you do. Mm-hmm. If you're pretty good and you've done a pretty good at choosing, maybe rebalance that. And that should be your total equity portfolio. Now, if you're young and you want to be aggressive, go all in on stocks if you want. Knock yourself out. It's going to be scary at times, but Warren Buffett would argue all day long it's the best return on your cash, right? Mm-hmm. As you get a little older, you need to dial back the heat, because you just might need the money and there might be a drawdown that you don't want to wait your way through. That's the only real reason. We understand that since time of memoriam, the market has largely compounded at 8%. The problem is you just don't want to have to survive a drawdown if you need the money and you get out over your skis. So for retail investors, I would say like, grab that, look at that portfolio and say, how aggressive do I want to be? If you want to be really aggressive, then index invest, you know, a lot of it and pick some stocks with some of the other stuff and go for it. Now, that's max risk. Everything back from there all the way down to your classic 60-40, just meaning that 60% of it would be deployed that way. So again, of that 60%, I would still say take 80-85% of it and stick it in indexes, because you're not going to be a great stock picker, at least initially. And then put some dream stocks in there. I think it makes it fun. And by the way, those tend to be higher beta stocks and usually do pretty well. The other side of the book is interesting. How do you get vol dampening? Boy, you know, I have to tell you something. This is a piece where I think we're really good at it. I only say that not so much, here, buy my stuff. That's not the point. The point is, so I fundamentally disagree with a lot of the classic ways. So buying bonds, okay. Bonds will absolutely dampen your portfolio over short-term sell-offs, probably. Right, unless we get into taper tantrum. The problem is if you get into a deeper sell-off, stocks and bonds move in the same direction. So I don't love bonds. Gold, guys that control a ton of money, like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater, he loves gold. He likes it, right? And he's certainly worth listening to, so who am I to stand against it? I think you're probably late in the move to run into gold now, but I do think if you're patient and wait for dips. By the way, I should have said, that wish list of stocks you pick out, wait for a sell-off.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Wait for a sell-off and buy them. Wait for it. You got it. You'll get them every so many years. It's going to come. Wait till you get that nice sell-off and pile in and take your stuff. Buy your dream list. And then don't sell them. Don't sell them when they go up 5. Just leave them alone. Let it marinate for a while, right? So the dampening part of your book. What hasn't evolved yet, in my opinion, is a set of retail products that are available to the masses that are like, you know, an ETF form or something that are effective vol dampening tools. I'm not seeing it. You can't buy the VIX. Do not go out and buy the VIX ETFs. Please understand, volatility decays, right? Theta decay is real. So you will lose money holding it. It decays. That's what it does. You have to trade it. And that's hard, timing it, right? Where volatility opened last January, right, which is very high just because the market's growing crazy in the fourth quarter, to where it closed this past December, so over 19, it was down 42%. So if you bought vol on Jan 1 last year, you lost half your money. So that, just to emphasize, and that was just a bad entry because vol was so spiked. I mean, now down here, I don't know that you'll lose half your money. Actually, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. Vol's pretty compressed. You might be able to buy some VIX ETF. But boy, this stuff just decays. It just decays. And so it's like, I would say, like, in the absence of any other good idea, maybe you buy, there's an ETF called IEF. An IEF is just a 7 to 10 year blend of U.S. sovereign debt. right? And maybe you just buy that and hold it and hope that it, like, you know, spikes a little when the market comes down and kind of gives you some protection. Look, if we go into that Armageddon sell-off where bonds and stocks go down, well, then you're just going to get beat up and nothing was going to work anyway. Maybe gold would have if you had it. Maybe. I don't know the answer. So to me, it's like, what I would do as a retail investor is I would look at my, and by the way, add in some of your money, maybe you can get into some REITs, some real estate trusts, things like that. There are some good REITs out there. Maybe put some real estate component into your book that looks interesting, right? There are, you know, so there's some things out there. There are some products out there that are pretty good. I'd stick with, you know, and you can kind of build yourself a book that has some equity indexing, some REIT ETFs, a little bit of IEF, and your dream list of stocks. And then someday when there's some really good alpha product available that's point and click, I think that has to make its way in. Or if you become sophisticated enough to seek it out. You have to become an accredited investor, which is a high hurdle, right? You have to, you know, I mean, right? We all know that. That's a high hurdle. Yeah. But it's coming, Nate. I mean, like, alpha will come to the retail market. Just, you know, it will come. I mean, if we're ever in a position to bring it, we're going to bring it, you know? Yeah. You know, we'll bring it when the time is right, you know? But, you know, we think it's doable. We do think it's doable. It can be brought in.
Right.
It can be accessible for everybody.
Very good. I think that's a good way to close. Chris Stanton, thank you so much for joining us.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.